tonight, especially because Allison and I are here in the village together. As all of you know, as your kids grow up and go away from home, you don't know for sure when you're together for any expanded length of time. And Holden has provided that for us. So we've been very grateful to hang out a little bit together last summer as well as this summer. My name is Karen Herseth-Wee. I'm from Northfield, Minnesota. I work as a secretary in the art department at St. Olaf College, where David has taught for 20-some years. Allison is our youngest of three children. Our oldest daughter, Rebecca, is 30 and is arriving in the village next week. Jonathan, sitting right out here, is here only a few days, leaving tomorrow. And Allison, here to perform for you. We thought that since this is going to be a performance tonight. It's not a writing workshop, so you don't have to get scared and get out papers and pencil and things like that. We may do some of that later. But I know that music is a very important part of telling stories, telling a life story. And so Allison is going to provide that gift to you, and then I'm going to read some things. David commented, I haven't been feeling very well the last couple days, so I haven't been around, but I wanted to go to Vespers tonight, and David commented, he said, you might get an allusion that you want to make to the Vespers, and I said, oh, that never happens to me. And lo and behold, I do have a comment I want to make. I really think that my writing comes out of Al Pitcher's metaphor of kicking rocks out of the road, trying to make a path straight, or trying to make something understood a little bit better. Communication, I think, is really what it's all about. Whether one is a songwriter, or a poet, or a storyteller, all of those things move in and out of one another. And as I read poems tonight that happen to have the particulars of my life experience, I think you'll all be aware that they have to do with everyone's experience, whether it's a trip to Martin Ridge, or some experience of being a young person, or whether it's parenting, or experiencing the death of a parent, or someone dear to you. I'm going to read a piece tonight about losing our family dog. Anyone who has had a pet will relate with that, whether it's our family dog or not. So to begin things, Allison's going to sing, I think, three pieces which she will introduce. These, I must say, I should interrupt. These lyrics are hers. The music is hers, not other people's music.
I was going to say that anyway.
Oh, good. Well, you forgot the other night. That's right. Thanks, Mom.
Yeah. I hope we're a little more adult than that these days in our ways of interacting, but once in a while.
Put us all in the car together and we revert right back to the old days.
That's true enough. Well, I was just working in the kitchen until about 8 o'clock, which I do here when I'm not performing. They didn't just ship me in for this performance. I work in the kitchen, and so I'm not all that prepared here, but Mom just said, oh, just do a couple of your pieces. And so I'm going to start with the first song that I ever wrote, which happened my junior year of college. And I was politically active on campus, and a few of the phrases were inspired from a Take Back the Night march that I attended that year on behalf of women's safety. And there's a lot of tension on the campus around there being a gay and lesbian student group and just turmoil, and this song came out of that, and it seems like a good starter here too. It's called Season of Rebirth. I have my words here because I don't remember it very well because it was a long time ago, so I wrote it down. But we'll
no one in this troubled world, not worth the time to care. Is anybody listening? Is anybody there? Sisters, brothers, all my friends, the job is ours to bring this system to an end.
I haven't written a ton of songs. It's kind of been this sporadic thing going on for the last 3 or 4 years. I don't know if art or writing or anything is like that for any of the rest of you, but once in a while things just sort of come out of nowhere. And this is one of those. So you'd drive down at 2 a.m. 'cause it
hard to be apart. And you kissed me on the forehead as I slept there in the dark. And you lay down beside me and leave again at dawn. But I could still feel you with me even after you'd gone. Oh, sometimes I wanna go back in time to a place my heart used to know, where I found happiness in your warm and gentle smile. And love was young and easy for a while. The years we spent together weren't all simple or all good, but we got by and always did the best we could. And I know that there are reasons why we thought that we should part, but that doesn't make it easier to heal this heart. I miss you, my friend, and I hope you're doing well. As for me, I think time will have to tell. Oh,
in the lift here at Holden, and it makes people laugh, so. So, it doesn't need an introduction, I guess. Gonna be together, I've been put on.
Experience. But it's my Martin Ridge hike. Some of you maybe know a physicist from California named Joe Jordan, and I was visiting with him on the patio last year, and he told us that we are all made of stars, literally. But it was hard for me to take it in, and it was kind of amazing, and I went back and wrote this piece about how we are made of stars. Joe Jordan from NASA says, as we stand on a patio in the Cascades one bright morning in July of 92, that we are all made of stars. That billions of years ago, the atoms burst when stars exploded and floated through time and galaxies and stratospheres into Earth's atmosphere, then entered a thunderstorm that hit Northfield the week before we left for Holden Village in September of 79, when I walked home in that downpour to pack away the last boxes for our renters, before a 6-month sabbatical at Holden, drenching my hair to the skull. So the star you saw above Martin Ridge that night in 79, as I trekked the hike of my life with Dan Erlander and Laura and Andy, might have been me. My mind's eye, born of stars, lit like a lighthouse, a beacon, right at the spot on Martin's Ridge where the mountain shoots down each side, leaving a 12-inch shelf where I humbly lower myself to my knees and crawl over to the next mountaintop. And then I thought I would read a piece that I wrote just last year. We had a family dog, a much-loved companion of the children and us, that died last year, and I ended up writing about it and thinking a lot about this whole process for human beings. And so I have a piece that describes the death of the dog, and then it moves to a very short poem about creatureliness and our similarity. This is called Duchess's Wee Amanda. Her name was Mandy. At 4 a.m., I awoke to Mandy's coughing up something slimy with a tiny white center, Lasix maybe. She wanted out. So I rose and opened the door, and she ran barking out under a full moon, over and down the slope to the west, briefly at one with all the unseen furrowed or burrowing creatures that were out and moving. When she returned to the door, she didn't want to eat. She wouldn't take the pill I had hidden in ice cream and soda crackers. An hour later, when I let her out again, she moved haltingly toward the neighbor's evergreens and seemed to melt away in the dusk. I realize now if I had not watched her in the next few minutes, she'd have moved away out of sight and I might never have found her. I went out and gathered her into my arms, but I could feel she did not want me to carry her back into the house. For the next 4 hours, she gasped, her chest heaving relentlessly, for she could not lie down, she could not rest, and we were at the vet's door when it opened at 8 a.m. At the vet's advice, we left Mandy there to receive fluids all day. We returned at 5:30, fully expecting to bring her home, but when we saw her, it was obvious immediately she would not come home with us. She was so sick. Grateful and happy to see us, she couldn't show it. She hung her head down toward the stainless steel table, seeming to be ashamed to be so sick, to be in this place at all. David and I thought our hearts would break. Neither of us could gulp out the words to tell the vet what needed to be done, but neither could we stay there with her like that, even for the 10 minutes that the vet suggested we could have with her. David soon asked him to come put her to sleep. We held her, one of us on each side of the table, and under our arms, she rolled slowly, instantly over onto her side and was still. We slid her into a plastic bag and brought her home in the trunk of the Buick, and I commented to the vet how unceremonious it all seemed, and he added, "It's so much better than most of them get." We left her in the car overnight, planning the next day to dig through the frozen top 6 inches of soil in our yard to bury her. But at the last minute, we changed our minds for Allison's sake, who would come home from Holden Village in the next 10 days. We put Mandy gently into our downstairs freezer to await Allison's farewell to her and her help in deciding this burial place. At least it would allow Allison a choice about seeing her. In the context of such unconditional love ends a span of time from 1979 to 1992, representing our lives as a young family together. Our children, now grown, range across the country from Washington, D.C. to California, to the state of Washington. Allison was 10 when Mandy came to live with us, Jonathan 13, Rebecca 16. The next evening, we looked through our pet file, and we were surprised to find an American Kennel Club certificate registering Mandy under the name of Duchess V. Amanda. I had forgotten she was registered. She'd been slightly oversized for a Shetland sheepdog, a Sheltie, and her ear tips not nicely folded down as they ought to. Most eerily surprising of all, we had put her down, as farm folks say, on the anniversary of her birthday. Mandy was 13 years old exactly to the day on March 19th. One day until spring, and although it's snowing hard, the mourning doves have arrived. Creatureliness. We presume so much that the family dog prefers indoors, our company, canned meat. When the time comes, might we not too say nothing, move due west toward the ghostly trees, and hope no one notices or stops us with catheters, stainless steel counters, fluids that drip from above? My poetry in the old days started out to be pretty angry feminist stuff. After I graduated from college and got married and found myself in suburbia with 3 children and hardly even getting out into these blizzards that everyone writes about, I felt like someone had pulled a trick on me, that I had always been told I could be anything I wanted to be by my family and by my education and by the culture I was in. But what I found was that something had just happened. I was suddenly the mom of these 3 kids and the wife of David, and I wasn't really who I hoped to be at all. And that's when I started writing poetry. So So I'll read you a few things from that old time. I'm also very aware of the situation for women in our culture and around the world. And most of my writing really reflects my trying to be sensitive to and trying to understand what that means to be a woman, not only in this culture, but in other cultures. Grace Paley says folks write what they want to read. If the bookmobile had been worn when I was young, say in my teens, I'd checked out comic books, Wonder Woman, Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, those small hardbounds by Walter Farley about the black stallion and his son. In those days, I secreted myself away to the hired man's loft and read forbidden pulp magazines about cowboy and cowgirl romances. I rode a white Welsh mare and flew over those years, barely touching the ground. I never gave writing a thought. Older, I'd choose Tess. Till I get to the part about Angel Clare and his double standard, I threw that darn book clear across the room and wouldn't go near it for weeks. Like John Fowles and the French Lieutenant's Woman, the least Hardy could have done was give me a couple of endings to choose from. I never thought to write one for myself. Now I read only women, all those folks left off of the reading lists and out of anthologies, those newly discovered, marginalized old witch women writers like Zora and Meridel, Wolf, Sappho, and I have begun to write some every day myself. Of girls and ropes and swings. One reads Frost for Boys and Birches, but what of girls and ropes and swings? Woman now, I sit a swing like a professional. I am experienced with swings. Ropes, haymow beams, burns, slivered wooden seats slung from elms near rivers, cute rhinestone bedecked swings in the clubs I've worked, and passes, peppermint striped painted steel to which tongues stick in winter, slaps on porches, kisses. I know the pain of girls and ropes and swings, the pumps that propel to uncertain heights. My poetry is a mask, a face I wear to legitimize the cries, the pain of women. Two-faced like drama, grins hide suicide, frowns fake fantasia in pantomime ancient as Rome. Color my mask, cochineal, in hues of cry. A red chorus hummed of females pinned in metamorphosis. Cochineal, if you don't know that dye, it's the name of the color red, but it's obtained from drying the bodies of female insects that are found only in Mexico. That's kind of interesting. Ecofeminism, the land, women, a lot in common, terrain a man would like to own. Abuse, poisonous as toxic water, falls on the ground, on skin, on bone. A champion of the land, I am loyal to women. It's a sin to treat both like trash. And there's no accident. There is a grain to go against called rape. Did you know there's a grain called rape? Power versus beauty, there are no words. There are no words, no combinations of spoken rhythms to describe the art of a dropped bomb as it hits a school, nor the resulting beauty of the billowing clouds and the flying atomic flesh just after. No words can relate about the thrust of a penis raised in hate or the innate beauty of bones receiving it. No screams can define a fist careening towards one's mouth or the beauty of the split-second silence just after. No words for horror going scot-free. And at one point in 86, David and I went with 30 students around the world. Wonderful places, India, Taiwan, Kyoto, Japan, and I ended up writing. It was hard to write about that experience because we were moving fast, and I don't think any of us write very well unless we're on the inside, if we can get under the skin of someone or a culture, and it was hard to do that, but I ended up trying to write about it. And the first of these poems is Pass. It's about our passport, and what a magic thing to have a passport it is. What a gift, what a privilege. Bombay could have been home, or Jerusalem. I could carry guns along the barbed fence in the Golan or wear tattooed numbers on the soft inside of my arm. Instead, a small blue book, number 07057511, graces my name. In New York, an old man leans against a skyscraper's ground floor window and stares up into the giant mouth of a beautiful billboard woman. Her red upper lip looms high above his head, and on tiptoe he stands to kiss the pane. Mutters into the chilly air, and behind him another shuffles by. She pulls a cart piled high with the pieces of her life. Later, after cheesecake and theater, we sit at a sidewalk cafe and watch a long black limo slide by, two svelte women staring out of it. Rome. It poured down rain, lightning and thunder came in the same instant, and still we ran, all 34 of us, for blocks, water sheeting off our eyeballs. Bernini statues on the Tiber Bridge stared through the rain without their corneas. Stone togas were soaked. Finally, seated for the audience, our clothes refused to dry, stuck to our skin, crept into crevices, and for 3 hours in 6 languages, the Pope spoke about something dark in Genesis. Sin, I think. One of us touched him. At that moment, under the Pope's very nose, an unknown man felt up one of our women. Eight stories up, this is Cairo, Egypt. A balcony view of the Nile, and Cairo glows the color of sand, rich in the burnish of bartered piastres, compounded on a black market. A sharp rap on our door, and Mahmoud slips in, and rolls of bills quicken in his lightning hands. Each day a maid changes our sheets, but years of dirt crouch in the corners of this room. A small refrigerator growls on the end of a bare wire cord. At breakfast, we drink red juice crushed from flowers, tea with lemon, hard toast, the ubiquitous strawberry jam on croissants, the hairs in them. We never look behind any doors. It was Halloween. I went to the vegetable market in Bangalore, India, for squash. She followed me from the street to every food stall and back out to the street again. I could buy nothing. Her hands were bound, feet too. I cannot tell you now the details because I couldn't really look. She had leprosy. On a cart in the street, her husband held a daughter waiting. I think it was a daughter. They too had leprosy. I couldn't really look. On the street, they followed me, she touching at my elbow with her bound hand. I kept walking, not looking down, kept walking with the friend Dinshaw whom we'd come with. He explained, do not give her anything. They make enough money begging, you know, to give them college educations. This one? This one, I thought. We rounded them all up once, he said, took them to a clean place of 3 meals a day, a cot. We got them off the streets. They wouldn't stay, you know, could make more money begging. Give her nothing. This one, I thought, as she pleaded with her eyes through our car window, now holding her rag-bound child swaddled close, her husband in the wooden cart behind her. He had been turning its wheels frantically with stumpy hands to catch us before our car pulled away. I bought nothing. I gave nothing. We returned to Dinshaw's home, to its cool marble tiled floors. Hiroshima, or Hiroshima. I have stood on the spot of the falling bomb. The Enola Gay shadow must have seen the giant bird coming in that day, or an angel leaving. I stood in the cold of a January day trying to imagine heat like that. Even the museum holding a man's shadow burnt into cement bank steps cannot tell of heat like that. A Japanese friend has brought me here, a man who was a boy in this city. He knew its alleys, the shortcuts, a good place to fish at the river, where to stand to say goodbye the longest to his father, a Navy ship captain, who came and went from the harbor and one day did not return. This man's mother has lived on alone 50 more years. My Japanese friend has not returned to Hiroshima for many years. Today he stands beside me. We touch the stone-cold monument dressed in origami cranes, colored like blessings. He smiles, says he remembers only two things, being hungry. Hungry for food, for books, always hungry. I've met his sons. They are tall. I tell him how fine and tall his sons are.
ask him if they had a tall grandfather or mother. He says no, hesitates. No, just food in their growing years. I have stood in the place of the falling bomb with this man, a poet, a writer, a Zen master who translates English novels into Japanese, who loves Gary Snyder, and knowing him just for a while is my blessing. And a year later, I was running along the highway in Northfield, August 6th, the day of the dropping of the bomb, and thinking about that. A morning not like any others ever. A red flame sun comes up. I run. The rosy mist surrounds each stack of corn, a sparrow carcass on the road, a hum of insects gathering power in ditches. And I remind myself not one bird falls to earth but that God knows, as she knew many years ago on an August morning in Japan when the sun came up, then fell into the middle of a city, as a child took a drink of water, closed the garden gate, and left for school on a morning not like any others ever. This next one is a love poem that I wrote for my family when I was home in Northfield. Chose to stay there on my own for a January that David brought students here to Holden Village. And I was sitting in the living room just listening. I heard planes going over, like we sometimes do here, and was just thinking about the luxury that you have to hear planes going over and you know they aren't going to bomb you. A love poem for the nuclear age after the bomb. Sometimes when I'm alone and hear the roar of distant planes, I think at last they've come. And you, my darling, gone, will never look me in the eyes again. The red flame wind will drop my house around me and my skin. My skeleton will bring its bony palm to its horrific mouth, then fall to dust, a signal only God the Mother sees. And from the radioactive dust, she'll make a clay undreamed of, and cast me new upon the wheel, then hand me back to you. It's the only sense I can make out of Holocaust. Okay, then we'll jump to a few farm kinds of things. I grew up on a ranch in South Dakota, and although I've now lived in Minnesota longer than the years that I was on this ranch in South Dakota, that land, its landscape, my experiences there have informed my life ever since, and I'm constantly feeling its loss. I feel the loss for a whole culture now that we are much more familiar on pavement than we are with our bare feet in the land, and so I write about it. I love original earth, like the pasture at home in Dakota that's never been plowed. Its curves reveal the circular shadows of Indian encampments, and past flowers, faint feathery blue, their saffron stamens reaching like feelers. I remember how my Mustang's hooves would crush them, yet the pasts return spring after spring, pushing aside dry clay, reaching for sky, yet tied to the earth, attempting to hold past and future in a balance. Every year between then and today, the curves of the land hide pheasant nest secrets. They contain the broken shells of my memory of mowing the blowing grasses, and how in that last round I would leap from the tractor and run through a narrow swath of still-standing brome, chasing out the small furred and feathered ones before finally thrusting a sickle through. Dad always wondered what took me so long in that last round, and I never told him. Older now, I wish I had, but I hadn't yet learned what we had in common, the prairie coursing in our veins like blood. Maybe if we had each sliced a wrist back then and held them tightly to each other, both of us would have been more grounded. I wonder what else might have been different. I grew up in a huge farmhouse. It was built in 1908, and the details of what that house is like are in this poem, which I'll read. It's also in this book, The Book of Hearts, which is new to me. This has just come out and has some of the things that I'm reading to you tonight, but not all of them. This is called The Heart of the Matter. This is a house with high ceilings, and it's why I've always felt a little bit, if I'm in houses with low ceilings, I kind of go around like this. It doesn't feel quite as good. This house, raised against all odds on the east side of Sand Lake in South Dakota, 1908, rebuilt itself in my heart. In the years after I was 20, I moved fast, moved 8 different places in fewer years, unaware that builders had been contracted and were already at work on a monumental task in my heart's space, oak banisters and all. 17 individually carved dowels to the landing, 27 more to the second floor, the bottom pillar with a loose lid where kids dropped a German oak nutcracker one holiday and we didn't tell. He lay there for years. Later I searched for him with a flashlight, but he'd gone and I don't know his rescuer. No other truly grand houses line Sand Lake, the kind with carved lintels above each downstairs window and sliding oak doors between the two largest rooms. But even such a house could not save Grandma Herseth from herself, her own dark interior, as Grandpa's large laugh resounded through its rooms after he had bet on horses or drunk himself into a stupor in distant towns. This house's attic, in my heart, allows such a view of distance that to this day hills or too many tall trees cause it me. Each spring, the pull of my body on my body home foreshadows the day my heart falls down, the great-grandfather clock finally quiet in the heart's room. A refinished bookcase that held cattle medicine in my young dad helping days is still in the basement. The dining room still contains a carved table, buffet, and 8 chairs that my mother bought for $74.88 when she was young, before her marriage even. My luck to be brought to this house in 1940, a newborn. I know its intimacies, every depth of corner. I can move in its dark without sound, my hand finding light switches or landing places before my head does. The women who come to live in this house with the men who own it do not know their way here as my sister and I do, and we banished ones resent those who later offer civilly to please feel at home. All the rest of the years that they live in this house, they will never carry its great weight in such a small space as a heart. Okay. You want to do your young woman sound? You don't. This one's called Too Soon September. One of the other, I try to write about the topics that other people don't talk about, like menopause and parenting gay children. We're coming to that part fairly soon. But I'll read you a couple of these ones that I feel about getting older. The whole phenomenon of the fact that you can't count on your body in the way that you could when you were young and you could take advantage of it. It's frustrating. I mean, you do come to live in some kind of grace with that fact, but it's still frustrating. A strong wind rattles these pages in my hands like someday my bones will when my breath leaves. 200 miles south, my husband works on the wedding. 2,000 miles to the east, our daughter prepares. I try to mark it, about the diligent man, her father, about the young woman who thinks a lot like me, except passionately. Where did such passion come from? Or rather, where did mine go? Out of me. In one flash, bones weakened and skin whitened like so much parchment. My legs have become stiff as birches. Suddenly, surrounded by seagulls, I thrust my neck up, back, up again, and am walking and screaming. In angry preening, I walk and scream. My knees, like the gulls, have grown knobby and covered with years. My husband stretches his hand north over the fir trees toward me. He means to pluck me back into this body he loves, yet I know I am leaving. I wait for a wedding that will spirit her away, yet I am the one who is going. My hope is the ceremony will distract everyone. Maybe even no one will notice. This body changed before my eyes, and I was helpless to stop it. Young, I had thought I was in charge, could will myself tall, slim, almost happy. But the body had other ideas, lowered its center of gravity from the head to the belly, preparing for, I don't know what. Although the bones talk about themselves mostly at night, and I dream in their language. Come morning, I cannot recall dialect, inflection, especially meaning. A few parenting poems. It will take her years and many men to realize how few and far between are the gentle ones, the ones who know women from the inside out, as her father does. It will take years of knowing many men who leave no faces in their wakes, only pretty images, light as snowflakes just before melting. Knowing that it will take her years and men, gnaws on his entrails from the inside out, and the already lean father grows more lean. This was my goodbye poem to my oldest daughter when she moved to Washington, D.C. She was going to study with Carolyn Forché, who is a poet, a political activist, writer who I have studied with. And once when I was taking a workshop from Forché, she had her three-year-old little son with her. And she had a babysitter trying to keep him out of her hair while she was teaching us. And the little three-year-old says, I will never leave you. I am your best friend. Now my daughter was going to study with Forché. So this is my poem about that. It's called, I Will Never Leave You. I Am Your Best Friend. Goodbye. I cannot say the word out loud all day today, you in the driveway, me driving away, although it's you who are leaving. I cannot speak this sorrow, how I will miss you, because I cannot add to your ache. Instead, I give your fiancé a coat of my father's, slip my sorrow into its light gray sleeves, fully clothed, not naked, like the part going north with me. Strange how I knew for months you were going, yet it came too quickly for words. I sit here tonight writing in the chill air 300 miles north of the cities. The birches shiver all the while that you drive to Virginia. Did I never tell you in my world east is an unnatural direction? Sorry. This sun, a uniquely graceful man whose diamond earring catches light or lightning, he can remember coal, the darkly moving moon, and with sleight of juggling hand and eye, tosses wit and depth and joy back to the source. And this was written, I don't know if he's heard it, after I heard that he hitchhiked for the first time. Hitchhiker, the ride is all, and doing it in pelt of, in heat or pelt of rain, enticed to the open road where all is swell and the ladybug riding on your sleeve reddens in the quiet, till the one car meant to haul you out roars up, stops, and you climb in, relieved. The stranger's window glass become kaleidoscope, focuses the shards of all the colored dreams you can't remember into one clear fragment you can almost touch. This son also had a motorcycle for a number of years. This is called A Mother's Pleas. Your motorcycle hums a spinning song. You whistle and ready yourself. Pack maps, addresses, sundries, an anniversary card, my size, all tied to the cycle with bungee cords. And then you head out into night and dark, clouds spitting lightning. Later you call from North Platte. The storm eluded you, tore north and east while you spun south. Now you own your own decisions and are not haunted by the uneasy wind of a mother's plea. Be careful, eat well, do not juggle the torches when they are too hot, or the sickles. Why not the multi-hued scarves instead? Once after a poetry reading, mostly feminist poems, a young woman came up and said, it must have been hard on your son and your family. Not really, I said, he's a juggler. We've both learned to keep many things up in the air at one time. Once after a particular ride, he and I, Jonathan, told me. A woman friend told me I listen better than most men she's met. Good, I thought. He's a listener as well as a juggler, and he knows where the empty spaces in a pattern are. Let's see. I've held you here long enough. reasons that I wanted to see all of my poems in one place was to, I guess we're back to kicking stones out of the road again. I've done quite a bit of thinking about parenting, and I've written some of my poems about my kids when they were very small and learned many years later that they were kind of foretelling, or they were noticing things that I didn't know how to read the signs about then. And one of those aspects that it is particularly true about is that Allison is our lesbian daughter, and we didn't always know that. We were, like many people, we thought we didn't know any lesbians or gay people until we discovered we'd been living with one for about 20 years, and that we had some new things to learn. And I can say it has been one of the most important, one of the most exciting, one of the most liberating things that has happened to us. And I thank God that we weren't given a choice to have to learn about this issue. I will read a few of these poems that I have written because of and on behalf of Allison, and then she's going to end with a song. When she was here, when she was 10, we'd gotten in some little mother-daughter snit of some sort, I forget what it was, but I felt very sad that she was angry with me, and so I wrote her a poem called Before Language, and that will be the last poem that I'll read tonight, because she since has written an answer to that poem. So that's how we will end. I don't know how to say this. You are not what I expected. Your father and I came together at a particular moment in our knowing, and from deep inside me, you already were made in the image of the great God who loves you even more than I do, and that's saying something. Made in my image too, of course, and your father's, the young years when you looked like him, the tomboy ones when you walked like me, and now a woman on course among careless teaching and wrong-headed ones. You make your way, all the while reaching a hand back to me. I will keep up, but am not as young as you, nor as urgent. But I am coming, dear heart. Don't get out of sight. I am coming, and I will bring others. I don't remember when I first knew of the wild gene loose in our family, but dressed in fringed leather, I stalked it all of my youth from the back of a horse. I avoided men, till one unlike the others came and stopped my quest. I saw it first, though, in a farm-bred aunt who left the farm by bus to teach from coast to coast. Always on the move, she kept open invitation wherever she lived for those who didn't fit. Then a nephew, drawn at 10 to the religion his mother left to marry a Lutheran, sought a monastery education like a moth finds flame. And you came, adept at math and music and secrets. I am surprised it took me so long to recognize that gate, when at age one you careened down the hall of our first home, marked even then by that wild gene. You arrived running, all bone and sinew, and on every photo after one sock wrinkles down. Later word comes from Lesbos that you are here only for a visit. I had thought you mine, that I could own you in my image. But you insist and show me the wonderful mind of your own, revealing the riblocked secret, your becoming self, coming fast before my very heart. Bringing up parents. You young parent in the city park with your proud eyes following that child over the jungle gym, think of it. She may be a baby dyke, the photos in your baby book forever revealing what you cannot yet name. Or you with the brown-eyed son who loves costumes and then lives in them, adopts another name for weeks at a time, insists on velvet, sometimes lace. Or the two of you, much decorated Navy captain and city librarian wife, with the ramrod young man taking all the honors in his class at West Point, yet he seldom writes home, holds his secrets so tightly to his chest that if he held out his hands, he might fly straight off the planet. So straight-laced this culture, narrow, no room for a gay heart to spread its wings, soar, damage done early. Parents of gay children throw off that embarrassment, send with pride the family Christmas photograph with your daughter holding her beloved's hand, new breed of pioneers, their child, much-loved grandbaby, cavorting between them, two wonderful mamas taking their urgent time bringing us all up. My mother and I wonder aloud to each other. My father and I loud wonders to each other. Sister and I wander away from each other. Brother and I with little to wonder about. Such a cushion to spring from. More like a trampoline. All the tendons and bone creating a springboard, and at any time one of us can fly out of sight. We keep doing our own individual leapings, our pirouettes, then springing off one or the other's most recent event. Like last Easter in a brown South Dakota park. The family was walking and talking. Two took strong issue, thought it the wrong time and place, but several others of us knew it was just right for the announcement made by a grandchild to her grandmother about the grandchild's gayness. And she and that grandchild sat long on a bench holding hands, the bone and sinew keeping the tension just right between them, while others of us flew at each other about timing and such, not admitting the issue lay deeper than we could go on the holiday. The real wonder was the tendons, tissue, and bone created a net that held, even as some of us flew off and up, having a long fall back. Before language. Daughter, sometimes I know your eyes follow me, and I would like to talk to you in the language of women, easy in each other's company. So often when I try, the words are wrong, my humor like a tune off key, not well received in your ear or your heart. But I promise I will wait for a day when we reach the same language, the sounds deep in our memories of another time, when in the womb, strumming the same chord, we needed no words.
Mom read that poem first, I think, when I was 13 and was still ornery. And when I started writing music on my guitar, I wrote this song, remembering that. I had to climb
My language has an unexpected accent, but our voices still are harmony. Two women dancing, dancing on common ground.
I'll go with you.